what that is, there you go. This is another of these newly released Steve Goodman CDs. This one's called Santa Ana Winds, and I just looked at engineer Dan Long and said, holy. Well, I didn't say holy Christ. I said something else, but I thought, man, this doesn't sound anything like this. Steve, you'll hear more. You'll hear more. It is my great pleasure to have in here Martha Bain and Vitaly Vladimirov. Vitaly is a writer, one of the writers included in the Chicago Neighborhood Guidebook, a new anthology that is edited by Martha. Martha was here probably a couple years ago, not exactly here, but certainly on my show on WGN, talking about a fabulous book, Rust Belt Chicago, an anthology, your first anthology. This, I have to tell, I love that book, Martha, as you know. Hi, how are you? Hi, Vitaly, how are you?
Hi, Rick.
You know I love that book.
Yes, you. Yes.
I like this one even more.
Well, thank you.
Let me ask you, this one is a incredibly distinctive, and I think people should. It's an essential element for any Chicago bookshelf because it will give you a Chicago that you don't normally see. There are, by, you know, city cartographers, 77 neighborhoods in this city. By real estate developers, there are probably 190 neighborhoods in the city. But very few people get to all of them. Mm-hmm. Very few people get to more than the one they live in, the one they work in. Take us back to the decision to do this book, how you decided on what neighborhoods, and was it a combination of finding an interesting writer? You and Vitaly met for the first time tonight, and I thought, mm-hmm. wow, that's great. You're one of the writers, but you're just
meeting.
I mean,
we've been corresponding for a year.
Of course. No, I don't doubt that for a second. But how does the process work?
Well, this book in particular is the third in a series of quote-unquote guidebooks that Belt Publishing, the publishing company I work with, has done. So we've done two, one for Cleveland and one for Detroit, that were modeled, that were similar, but each one's been a little bit different. But what they share is that they're really not these, they're not what anybody would actually call a guidebook in any kind of useful way.
Well, a couple of the chapters in here are done in kind of guidebook
fashion. Some of them are a little more guidebooky than others, but what it really is a collection of essays and photography and poems, and it's very personal. And not comprehensive and not prescriptive at all.
And not meant to be.
But in terms of how this one came together, I mean, I really like...
You're a longtime journalist in this town. You have certain connections in
I think that I do have a network, although it's also that network has shifted and evolved and warped over time.
As journalism has.
I think my network isn't just limited to journalists necessarily.
Oh, but not
to
at all.
Writers,
yeah.
and people who... And doers, people who do interesting things and like to talk about them. But for this, what I really wanted, I let the writing itself shape the structure of the book. So I didn't really go out and say, like, okay, you write about this neighborhood, you write about that neighborhood, you write about this neighborhood. I started by putting out an open call for submissions, which is where you came from.
Exactly.
And I tried to spread that across as many networks and platforms as I could. I asked people that I knew who maybe were connected to other writing groups, or writing scenes that I wasn't connected to spread the word.
And I have to say, I got the link to the submission, like, well over a dozen times. I had so many people.
Oh, God. I didn't know that. That's great.
Well, the other thing I'm going to ask is I could imagine that you would get swamped.
Yeah, well, I was interesting. I was swamped, but it was not a comprehensive swamping. It was very, like, there were still giant, empty, dry pockets of the city where I had gotten no submissions. So that was when I started doing some targeted outreach. And I reached out to some writers and I said, hey, will you write about this neighborhood?
Vitaly, when you first saw this and jumped on it, what was the appeal for you?
Well, the appeal for me was multifold. I have been collecting these stories and these narratives in and about Uptown for a while when I saw the call for submissions. And so when I saw the link, for me, it was an opportunity to share a story that I knew was very special and a story that is really so unique and so wildly unexpected that anytime I shared it with people, they were just so...
Well, Vitaly brought in a small notebook filled with with these notations.
So for anyone who hasn't read the piece,
Oh, that's plenty. That's probably everybody listening.
Since the book's I've not read actually the piece. Out yet.
Yeah, oh. The book is not out yet. So if you've read the book, you're something of a miracle worker.
Well, I see. So, well, a slight summary then is
yes.
I spent well over a year gathering oral histories on Argyle Street in Uptown, where I asked people to share a memory of the street, this area that is known for its Asian American identity and character, with all the pho and Chinese restaurants there. And I did so because the area is in rapid flux. It's changing quickly for many reasons, and I wanted to go out there and just talk to people and write down this history that I knew was very fleeting. And so I have been doing this for about a year, and I have these hundreds of scraps that I've brought with me to the studio that are just on post-it notes. People posted them on these boards that I had right on Argyle, and so when I saw the link, I had been sitting on this trove of stuff, and I just really wanted the opportunity to share this history, this narrative of people who have been in and about Argyle for decades.
In your piece, which is titled Uptown, A Trip to the Argyle Museum of Memories, you include, I'm not going to admit, perhaps dozens of these, you include about a dozen of these mm-hmm. memories among them. Here's an example. We moved to Uptown in 1977. One of my earliest memories were attending carnivals at Foster and Sheridan. Uptown instilled in me a love of food that remains today. So they are memories, but they also are impressionistic memories. Yes, that's, to my mind, the great appeal of your piece.
I only gave people a very small post-it, you know, like a large post-it to write on, and so there's just not a lot of space, and, you know, this is at a festival. They're there to have fun, and I'm like, hey, tell me a memory.
After you gather these, and they're in a nice notebook, I think it would be some kind of art exhibit, but after you gathered these, what was your intention? What did you think of doing with them until Martha came into your life?
I honestly had no idea. That wasn't even a concern. I felt like I was doing triage.
You weren't being pragmatic about it.
No, I felt like I was doing triage. I mean, this place is hemorrhaging people, and with them, memories, and so I felt like I just had to, like, jump in and gather as much as I could. And so then the link for Martha's guidebook was then very opportune, because I felt like this was an opportunity for me to lock in and write down some of this stuff that I've gathered. And I knew that I included all those memories in my piece.
Well, and you also included, you know, you did a fine job. I don't know if you're a trained journalist. I think you're an academic, aren't you? What do you do?
So I'm an urban planner by training.
That's right. You're an academic, but an urban planner.
That's right.
You're an academic. And you have your own
social scientist.
Yeah, you can learn more. He has his own website, which we will tell you about later.
Yes.
But part of it is you did considerable research here, too. You give people a pretty decent, you know, as we were talking outside, a decent history of Uptown could run to 500 pages
right.
if need
and
be.
And that's if I can just jump in, that's what I really like about this piece, is that I feel like it really fuses history and personal history
no
and memory
question.
In this way that it's very much an exemplar of the kind of work that I was really hoping to get for this anthology.
You know, one of the things.
Because I didn't want it to be a history.
No,
a book about
not.
History. I want it to be very contemporary, but you can't talk about neighborhoods and you can't talk about cities without talking about history.
One of the other hallmarks of this book, and again, it is called the Chicago Neighborhood Guidebook. What I find, and I'd like you both, because obviously if I tell you've read other submissions,
sure.
you can just write your own over and over, as good as it is, over and over again, is there is a quality in here of searching for meaning, of searching for place. We got to take a short commercial break, but Martha Bain and Vitaly Vladimirov, I want you to talk about that, because that's one of the things I got out of this book. You know, what does it mean? But, you know, talking about Marquette Park, mm-hmm. for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So please stay tuned. This week on Chicago's Best, the team is cooking up everything from the Chicago char dog to an Italian sausage. There are also two prominent pizza places mentioned in this book, the Chicago Neighborhood Guide. Welcome back. We're talking about the newly published book called The Chicago Neighborhood Guide, edited by my friend Martha Bain and published by Belt Publishing. Belt Publishing has a fine array of books you will not find at in your grocery store, beltpublishing.com. Vitaly Vladimirov, one of the contributors to the Chicago Neighborhood Guidebook, with an insightful and charming and entertaining take about Uptown, sort of focused on Argyle Avenue when he lived there and when he asked people what they thought about Uptown. Martha, when the submissions started to come in, what kind of editing did you have to do to many or most of them?
I think I took a pretty light hand for me.
Got no edits.
Yeah, your piece didn't really get any edits. They were all copy
edited. No wonder
you
like meeting each other. An editor who doesn't edit and a writer who doesn't need editing.
There were a handful of pieces that I took a more kind of developmental editorial approach to. But I would say there was maybe half a dozen total. And the rest of them, you know, they were good, so that's why I wanted them in the book.
Yeah.
So they already spoke for themselves.
What about, I asked you before, unbelievably, I remember what I asked you before the commercial break. I said that one of the threads in the book for me and in many, many of the pieces is a kind of search for the meaning of a neighborhood.
Yeah.
And a search for the meaning of how that neighborhood plays a part, not just as its own entity, but as a part of the city. Did you both sense that too, or am I?
Definitely.
For my piece, what was really important is, you know, I'm personally also an immigrant. I came to America from Russia, and living in a neighborhood that is so closely tied to an immigrant identity of Southeast Asian folks, for me was really beautiful and poignant. And, you know, there's not a Russian neighborhood anywhere in Chicago. And so for me, being in Argyle is very special because it's a place built by immigrants. Mm-hmm. And so it accesses like a part of something inside of me that's very personal. And so that's part of the connection that I felt with it. And even though I'm not Asian, I felt like it was extremely important for me to write about it so that I could preserve this thing. And so that's part of what I was searching for. And reading some of the other pieces, two, it's, you know, really trying to understand boundaries and where we sort of position ourselves in the city, the way that we inhabit urban space. You know, these are things that I think about as an urban planner, and, you know, sort of the boxes that we put ourselves into as residents of this very beautiful but very broken city. Mm-hmm. And so, so what's really beautiful about this book for me is the way that the boundaries seem to fall apart. You know, it starts off with Austin, and that piece is written at the very edge of the city.
Mm-hmm. Let me read something. It's from the chapter by my a friend of mine. I do not know everybody in this book. I am thrilled to meet people I have never met before, writers. Gint Aris is a fascinating guy. He writes novels, mm-hmm. and he's written in this book about Marquette Park, mm-hmm. Members only. And at the end of this piece, he's talking about a vanished social club of his youth. He writes, Marquette Park use the codes of ethnicity and race. And this literally, talk about a universal paragraph that could apply to virtually every neighborhood here. Its membership depended on a kind of paranoia that's based almost entirely on lines we're too frightened to examine. That's the lesson Marquette Park offers everyone on the outside, and the value of its history. We fear adding members to our club will kill the club's identity. That's to say, if I cannot be who I understand myself to be right now, it means I can't be anything at all. Perhaps it's time to have fewer small clubs on opposite sides of the street, but extend invitations to those who suffered from history's monster. If we count up the members of that club, we'll find that it's very large.
Yeah.
That, do you both not think, is a paragraph that captures a great deal of the emotional power of this book.
Yeah, that's a kicker of a paragraph. And
yeah.
I think that it really speaks to the search for identity that I think runs through the book, and the search for stability. I don't want to necessarily say it's safety, but stability. I think that there's so much, we're living in a city that is changing. I mean, any city is changing all the time, but I think it's undeniable that it's changing very rapidly in the 21st century. As we know, it changed a lot under the former mayor, which I alluded to a little bit in the book, and which is talked about in the epilogue to the book. So people are searching for something to hold on to, whether it's personal identity, ethnic identity.
Or their peace
or just
of
a sense
the city.
Of, yeah, their history, their personal history.
Yeah.
A lot of, it is impossible, I've discovered, to have people write about places without writing about, without it having an element of nostalgia. I think that the book works fairly successfully at not giving into sort of like sort of cloying nostalgia. But there's this sense of loss that runs through it, and a sense of trying to hold on to something that's slipping away. And
well, but also in that one bit that I read from Vitale's Uptown story about someone remembers, it's like remember moving there in 1977. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are tied mm-hmm. to the city. There is nothing wrong as we rush toward the future and the hip new restaurant on Randolph Street to remember the past, because that absolutely tells you where you are. Well, you're an urban planner. You've got to know that.
Exactly.
And the past is visible every time you walk down the street.
Speaking of the past, actually...
Well, it's vanishing here and there, but yeah, I know
you know,
what
before,
you mean.
Before Argyle was Asian, it was actually a Jewish neighborhood.
Sure.
And there was a tiny little trace of that in this drugstore sign that was tucked under the awning of a Vietnamese travel agency.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that storefront actually is now under repair. The mm-hmm. building is still Asian-owned, but... I was walking down the street. I had been out of town, and the sign for the drugstore had been pulled off and broken. And I was just like, no. And I really examined it, and I actually pulled out the glass shards and I arranged them and I took some pictures of the broken sign. But I was just like, well, what is it that I'm feeling a sense of loss for? So for me, it was enough just to take the picture and move on. But
see, even you as an immigrant, I mean, you are not looking at something on Argyle Street and hearkening back to Odessa or Minsk or
right.
something. You are hearkening here. And
right.
and there are those signs all over the place. I don't care whether it's a tree. I hate when they tell, I'm not one of these preserve every old building, but you got to preserve some.
Yeah.
And I think that is, you know, here's the chapter, a fascinating chapter, Pilsen. The quietest form of displacement in a changing barrio.
Mm-hmm.
What you will get from this book, ladies and gentlemen, I think my two guests will agree, is a real, real sense of Chicago. Not the Chicago you see on the nightly news where there's a killing in Garfield Park. If you have lived here long enough, I know people who grew up in Garfield Park, and they will go back to just see and remember. And that's a huge part of this, Martha, isn't it?
Definitely. And I think, but I also think, like, Garfield Park's an interesting example because the Garfield Park's represented in the book by a photo essay
yep.
by a photographer named Gabriel Michael. And it's beautiful. I mean, his photographs of Garfield Park a lot of them are of what might be considered, you know, blighted structures or something, or just sort of urban... general
decay,
urban decay,
quote unquote blight.
Right.
But they're really beautiful. And there's one picture in there that I just really love, which is a picture of the lagoon in Garfield Park near the dome, looking out, and you can see the Sears Tower in the background. And that to me is like such an iconic Chicago image.
In that photo essay, the one picture I like is the building from the 1890s mm-hmm. in the middle of demolition. Mm-hmm. And for me as an urban planner, I'm like, you know, we're just, again, speaking of memory, we're just throwing away our legacy, mm-hmm. you know, because here's a building, Chicago's so new, and here's a building from the 1800s, and we're just demolishing it mm-hmm. with no care.
And with no care, and I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, it's there. A 3100 block of West Lake Street, yeah. built in 1869. And you know fully well, and there's another one here under demolition. This is a sad one at 734 South Sacramento that was built in 1894. With all due respect to urban planning, some buildings need to be torn down.
Of course.
There's no doubt about it. But maybe if you become the city's urban planner, you can. It has to be done with some discretion. And I think
Miss Life was listening.
And some, maybe she is. And you'll work for cheap, and she won't have to bust her budget on this thing. You know, but done with some discrimination, not just ooh, look, that's old, let's tear it down.
So you know,
there's a
go ahead.
There's an incentive, you know, there's always an incentive to build new because it creates jobs. So they're
allegedly.
All bound up together, but I won't go down that track.
The thing that I want to say, too, is, you know, the narratives that we're sort of fed about Chicago versus, you know, what you get from this book is you know, there's this comfort that we have in these very common narratives of, you know, rich versus poor, black versus white, north versus south. And it completely misses the point. And, it's almost like fast food. You know, it's this junk food that we consume, and mm-hmm. we are all
I'm not sure there's that much comfort in those.
Well, but,
in those
but you know, but it makes certain people
troubles.
Feel better about themselves, and so, you know. I'm very much a person who thinks, you know, sure, I live in Edgewater, but what happens in Garfield Park is extremely important to me, and I care very deeply about what happens in other parts of the city. And this book really makes you care in a way that perhaps is...
Well, it gives you insights into the part of the cities that you do not go. As an urban planner, I have to think that you travel the city in the
sure.
same way I do as a reporter trying to find mm-hmm. stories out there. But very few people, you know... Bus drivers have a route. Cops have a district. Mailmen have their routes. There are very few people who have the joyful freedom to travel and sort of get a glimpse of the city. And I think that is one of the essential things this book provides.
If this book motivates people to do that, I will be very happy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, these boundaries, though, oftentimes are self-imposed.
Sure.
And, you know, we put ourselves in these bubbles and, you know, It only reinforces the things that are broken about our city. And, you know, if we are to try to fix anything in
well,
our
people,
wonderful city...
People, I mean, people fall into those patterns because they...
Because they choose to.
And yes, but also because there's comfort in it. There are kids living in Lawndale who have never seen the lake here. And the reasons are fearfulness, lack of financial means... There are a lot of reasons for it,
sure.
I think. We'll continue on. Again, the book is... And they're having events coming up. Where you can meet these people who were responsible for the fantastic The Chicago Neighborhood Guidebook. So stay tuned.
Time to get back to Mr. Rick Kogan on 720 WGN.
Thanks a lot, Roger. You will find such notable authors in this book as Kevin Koval, the poet... Dmitry Samarov, the incredibly prolific writer and artist, but you will also discover new talents. That's one of the reasons you should buy the Chicago Neighborhood book. Vitaly Vladimirov is one of those new talents. And God, come on, Lori Lightfoot, hire this kid to.
Well, I will say I work
planner.
For a pretty badass woman-owned. Urban planning consulting firm, and we're trying to do things different and better so that we can have better places that
good,
work
because
for more.
The new generation's got to be the generation that fixes what ails this town. Vitaly, you have a website of your own, don't you? What is it?
I do. It's vitalyv.com, VitalyV.com. And aside from writing pieces such as this, I also do walking tours. So I actually have some walks I'm planning as part of the Chicago Architecture Biennial in early October under a project called Jane's Walks Chicago to honor Jane Jacobs, the urbanist.
Yeah, the great urbanist. Also, Martha Bain, you got parties coming up on Wednesday. Wednesday the 11th.
Wednesday, September 11th is the big book release party at the Hideout, and it's at 5:30. And we have a slew. We have 9 contributors reading at that. There are 45 contributors to the book, and maybe 10 of them don't live in Chicago, but the rest, now they used
yeah,
to.
Yeah, of course.
But
they
but I really wanted to try and give everybody in the book a chance to...
A stage to
present their
page.
Work if they wanted
yeah.
to. I still haven't quite got there yet. I may have to schedule one more event. But good. We have There's 4 enough. So far.
And people can go... Is all this information at beltpublishing.com?
All the information is on the events page at beltpublishing.com.
There's another one at the Mars Community Brewing in
Bridgeport on
another
September
17th.
Another
one at the Hopleaf in Andersonville.
One at the Hopleaf is on the 1st of October. And then there's one at Rose's Lounge in Humboldt Park on October 9th.
You must have, from people beside myself and John Warner writing in the Chicago Tribune, a great deal of praise so far, even though it's just about to be published. Yeah.
Not yet so far.
Okay.
But the Tribune review that came out this week was really just really wonderful and a total surprise. But I have done some interviews over the summer with different journalists, and so there should be some other pieces rolling out in the next
good.
Week or two that
I don't
I'm
even
not
care
sure
about
exactly.
That. I'm endorsing this book. You've heard these two talk for the last 40 minutes or so. The Chicago Neighborhood Guidebook. You would be a fool not to have this on your bookshelf, and you would be. It will introduce you to Chicago today. It will not have every single nuance of every neighborhood. It does not have reference much beyond Vito and Nick's and Pudgy's Pizza. It is not that kind of conventional guidebook, of which there are many and which most of them are no good. Someone could come to Chicago. Then one of the things I'd love to say, I know this book probably won't be sold at airport bookshops, unfortunately. But
those
to come to Chicago,
surprise.
To come to Chicago and have someone get this book and read it on the 2-hour flight back to Manhattan and get off and go, oh my God, I stayed at the Intercontinental Hotel, but do I know Chicago now? They really will do that. Congratulations to you, Vitaly. I think it's a great piece. It's about Uptown, kind of focused on Argyle Street, but also focused on the people who wander and live and work and love on Argyle
Street. There's so much to say about that part of the city, Argyle. There's new people coming in constantly, new businesses, new stories to be told.
Yeah, always. That's the great thing about living in a place like Chicago. Martha, congratulations. This is really an essential and tremendously enjoyable book, too.
Yeah,
thank you, Rick.
Just really quickly, I do think it is really wonderful in part that it does change a lot of the narratives around Chicago are just so tired. And this book is truly uplifting. It's kind of life-affirming. I mean, it's just very moving. Some of the pieces in here are just so poignant, and it's just amazing how much emotion can be packed in some 3,000 words.
There's heart and soul in here. You have 45 writers seeking the meaning and the heart
in weird places, in some strange corners of Chicago, which is what I love about it.
That's the best thing about it. Yeah. Even if you think you know Chicago, you will find new parts of Chicago.
I've lived here for 10 years, and it's all new to me. So
I've lived here considerably longer than 10 years and written about it consistently, and I found new things.
You should be in the book.
What?
Why aren't you in the book?
Someone should have interviewed me. And next book. Vitaly to interview me for the book.
Sign me up.
Yeah, you're signed up. If you can't be the urban planner for the city of Chicago, you can interview Rick Kogan for it. Martha, congratulations. These two books back-to-back are really something. I don't know what you're going to do next, but you've set the bar pretty high.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Vitaly, we'll do an interview one day. We'll be back and talk about the Season of Concern in a few minutes. Merry Christmas, everybody. Merry Christmas. We will explain what that song is, because I'm here to talk about Season of Concern and Monday, September 9th, 7:30 at the Mercury Theater, the Season of Concern Divas. I'm here with Corey Goodrich, who's the co-producer, and Eugene Dizon, the musical director and producer. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
First, tell me about, I've known about Season of Concern for these many years. It has raised many millions of dollars to help fund people afflicted with and trying to survive what was at one point the real scourge of the theater community in Chicago. Hi.
Well, Season of Concern.
On that upbeat note, yes, let's carry on.
Usually they call me the scourge of the theater community.
Oh, dear.
So Season of Concern was developed the 90s? In response to the AIDS crisis. And since then, actors, we don't make a lot of money.
It's almost $3 million now that you've raised. It's a lot of money.
And it helps a lot of people in our community who, we go from paycheck to paycheck a lot of times, and when you get sick, you don't work and you lose your insurance, which is why this is so important to raise money for people who are suffering from not only HIV and AIDS, but cancer or any life-threatening illness.
Well, and also, some people who have lost the ability to work wind up with no place to live.
That's right.
Too. I mean,
that's
there
right.
are all manner. What struck me in the material, and first of all, my great friend Jane Solins, for whom I would do anything, I would have on this show almost anybody, but she said, now, Rick, you've not had on the Season of Concern people in so long. Why won't you do that? Jane's one of the board of directors. What strikes me, what is interesting about this is wonderfully AIDS and HIV have sort of faded off the front pages because they have become more manageable and even in many ways curable. But that does not diminish the fact that it is still a horrible problem.
It's a horrible problem.
It really is.
It really is.
Don't you think, though? I mean, people, the common perception is, oh, well, that's Magic Johnson, he's fine, and now everybody else is fine.
But they're fine, too. Now, correct me, like, there's a plethora of drugs you can take, but drugs cost money, too.
And, sure.
Correct.
You know, and a lot of these people, they're not able to work, as you had mentioned. So they need some help, and these artists, they don't have, sometimes they don't have insurance, sometimes their insurance can't cover all that stuff, so that's
I'm thinking even more than sometimes. Mm-hmm. I would almost hazard to say, as you talk paycheck to paycheck,
right.
The benefits for people other than Brad Pitt are relatively limited. How long have you two been involved, Corey?
Well, we started working together 7 years ago, seven or eight years ago. We produced a series of albums called Season of Carols, and we've done six albums together.
Whose idea was that?
It was both our ideas. We at first we had a meeting together in January after we had just finished doing the Christmas Schooner at the Mercury, and Corey said, you know, I really wanted to give back, and I wanted to record a song, and the proceeds to give back to Season of Concern. And that's how it started, because then I thought, I had always remembered the Second City Divas CD that was done at the Mercury 30 years ago,
sure,
when Michael Collin created the Mercury.
No, Michael.
And a lovely man.
Oh.
He's still around.
Yeah,
he comes and visits me all the time.
Well, Michael and I go way back. I go way back to Michael's. When you say Michael Collin, people go, is he a friend of yours? Yeah, I know Michael for a long time.
But, you know, that seed and that meeting really spurred us on to say, you know, we really want to display the talents of Chicago theater that no one gets to hear beyond seeing them on stage.
Was Season of Concern previous to that simply a sort of support group, and or did you do benefits, and did you must have done something as fundraisers?
They do the AIDS walk. They do a number of other benefits.
And they did an annual benefit where they would give their awards every year for either the Larry Sloan Award, or they have a Legacy Award, and they have other awards that they give, a Heritage Award as well, that a lot of theaters get. But then we knew, as artists, Corey and myself, we wanted to give back to the community, and we certainly don't have tons of money.
Yeah.
So instead,
exactly,
all we have is our talent and our connections.
All we have is our talent.
Well, but I mean, you know, the legendary Chicago theater scene, although, you know, dominated by jokers like all friends of mine, Bill Peterson, John Malkovich, who I know cannot sing. The musical talent in this city is astonishing. Is it not?
It is second to none.
Yeah.
These women, and we'll talk about these women.
Yeah,
too,
absolutely.
Because this started as the Second City Divas 4.0, we're calling it, was started by Roberta Dunchek, and Roberta was on the original two Diva albums, and she just wanted to create this group where we got together. The women got together. We're all over 40. That's sort of a...
It was a social group.
Because we never worked together.
Yeah.
Exactly. We, you know, there's only like room for one diva per show, or maybe two if
maybe
you have an
understudy. Maybe two, but not usually.
Yeah. So we would get together once a month, and we would just, you know, kind of drink together and talk and have fun. And we had so much camaraderie that last year when we were doing the Christmas album, we said, let's get the Second City Divas to sing Carol of the Bells, which you just heard.
Yeah.
And that was so much fun. We're like, we have to do a whole concert.
Yeah.
Because these women are in their prime. They are so strong and smart and savvy, and they're not working as much as they should.
Do me a favor, Corey and Eugene. I think the word diva is so misused in the common vernacular that it might as well be bitch, frankly.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
And I think this kind of I've never, ever thought that. I think I've gotten it. I didn't always think, oh, Maria Callas is a diva. But how do you define it, Corey? I think it's a very empowering word.
Absolutely. Well, I looked up the classic definition, which I can't quote, but it's like usually a woman who is complaining about, you know,
exactly,
her situation.
Exactly, complaining.
But I think it is a woman who is in charge of her power, in charge of her talents, who knows what she wants. And when a woman speaks up sometimes, then you get labeled a diva or a bitch or, that's not necessarily the truth. The women, we were rehearsing today, and They blew me away. I was on the floor laughing because they're so funny and they're collaborative. Mm-hmm. They were sitting there, you know, throwing things and ideas back together. Nobody got angry that somebody else gave them a line reader. They were working collaboratively to make this a fantastic
And I'm sure
thing.
the whole scene, especially for maybe for you, Eugene, as a co-producer and the musical director of this thing, you must see in front of you a bunch of accomplished women feeling empowered in a different way than you get empowered playing a role on stage.
It's true. I mean, these women, another word I thought of for these divas is that they're worldly. They have experienced mm-hmm. the world. They have worked with terrible producers, wonderful producers, wonderful directors, horrible
terrible
directors. And they've gathered all of this knowledge and all of this history, and they're able to display all of that on stage now through song.
Yeah.
And it's amazing what they can bring, but yet there aren't enough women roles right now. And especially women roles that are leading lady roles that are over 40.
Exactly.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
They don't
yep.
create those anymore.
Right. You're either, as a woman, you're either the ingenue, you're the leading lady, or the love interest, or you're the crone.
Or the horrible mother-in-law.
Yeah. There's a multitude of layers in between that. And so we need to write more music and write more plays for women.
This takes place, the Season of Concerned Divas takes place a week from Monday at 7:30 at the Mercury Theater Chicago. I was there when Michael Cullen took me in to, do you think I should buy this theater? He and Joe Carlucci were somehow teamed then. It's at, you know where it is, it's at 3745 North Southport. Seasonofconcern.org is the website, the means to buy tickets. It goes to a good cause, but it also sounds so, so fun. You are winning the Larry Sloan Award this year. You have won it before. What is the Larry Sloan Award? It is given to one who
works their butt off.
Larry Sloan was one mm-hmm. of a dear friend of mine, one of the grand talents in this town, who was contracted HIV in the late 80s and died of AIDS very early in 1995. He was the artistic director of Remain, the legendary Remains Theater.
Oh,
he
yes.
worked at the Goodman.
Mm-hmm.
And he was 35 years old. There are people, certainly, who attend the thing who remember mm-hmm. Larry. And there's a joyfulness, too, in honoring people who were working in this organization. It matters now, mm-hmm. but when it was really life and death.
Right. It was right. vital for yeah. those artists, you
yeah.
know, and I've lost a number of friends during that period, and they all went to Season of Concern for help because they helped them with their rent. They couldn't pay their rent. They couldn't pay their light bill. You know, it's such a great organization. We are so lucky that we've been able to raise all this money for them over all these CDs, and we're hoping that this CD will sell out all the others because, yeah. you know, this is featuring the talent of Chicago and the history of theater for the past 40 years.
So are you recording this upcoming
show? We are.
Oh,
yeah.
And you're going to come
in.
That's going to be your first non-Christmas CD?
Yes.
Yes, for those of you who have the entire Season of Concern Christmas CDs, this will be a new addition to your show.
Yes.
That is just a great idea. How do you orchestrate, how many divas will there be?
38, I believe. We are 38.
There are some
women.
Solos and some mm-hmm. duets and some,
trios,
I'm assuming,
yeah.
bigger pieces. You're the co-producers of this thing. This must be a bear to pull off.
We were just
it?
Talking about
yeah.
how much more work this is, and it's such a concentrated time frame versus the Season of Carol CD, where we had 2 months of recording sessions, and then we would mix for another month. We literally have one take. Just the one take. And whatever happens, We'll be on the recording.
Well, I actually think you too. That's going to be so exciting.
Isn't that more fun, actually, if they do mess up?
Oh, and wouldn't you like to be at this live recording session? Now I'm billing it as a live recording session.
It is.
Season of Concerned Divas. What are you going to title the CD? Do you know yet or no?
I don't know. Right now it's the Second City Divas in concert. So we'll see. Maybe we'll come up with something clever.
It is Monday, September 9th at 7:30 at the Mercury Theater, Chicago. You can call. I don't know anybody who calls for tickets anymore, but I'm going to give you a number. 773-325-1700 or go to seasonofconcern.org. Do go to seasonofconcern.org because on a phone line, you don't get a lot of extra information. There's no really embellishing information. You can really learn what Season of Concern does. One of the stunning things about it, too, is that this nearly $3 million that has been given over the last, again, almost 30 years.
Yeah, 30 years.
30 years to more than 30, maybe 40 sort of AIDS service organizations. Mm-hmm. That's a stunning number to me, too. And that just shows the need out there. We got to take a commercial break. When we come back, we'll talk a little more with Corey Goodrich and Eugene Dizon. And you'll hear another Christmas song. Right, Dan?
Sure.
Yeah, Dan Long loves the Christmas songs. Now, we got to get some news, and we'll be back. Chicago Stories told 24-7 on WGN 720 Chicago. Smart speaker users just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. It is 10 o'clock.
And wild and sweet, the words repeat of peace on earth. The day had come, the belfries of all Christendom had rung so long, the unbroken song.
Merry Christmas again. You're listening to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan, on a September 1st evening, and we are playing songs from the six or seven, how many?
Six.
Six. That's Eugene Dizon, who's the producer, musical director, and Corey Goodrich, who didn't get in quick enough on that answer. They are the co-producers of this year's Season of Concerned Divas, which takes place Monday, a week from tomorrow, which is Labor Day. Monday, September 9th at 7:30 at the Mercury Theater on 3745 North South Boulevard. If you've been to the theater in Chicago, you've been to the Mercury. Go to seasonofconcern.org to get tickets for the live recording, performance recording.
That's right.
Of the newest Divas CD. Again, you two, you only have a week. I'm surprised you're both ambulatory dealing with the production. How many songs are in the show?
Oh. 16.
16.
16 songs. We have solos, duets, we have some group numbers.
Opening,
there may
closing
be some
number, an encore. We have an encore.
Who has selected the songs? I mean, it must be a collaborative effort.
Mostly Roberta. Roberta is pretty much in charge of all the music programs.
Yeah, picking
all
the songs.
Roberta Ducek is wonderful. And she is now going to be music directing Six on Broadway. That was at Chicago Shakes here.
Yeah.
So she's a big
here.
Deal. And,
yeah.
and you know,
we're
I
lucky
up,
to have her.
Well,
I played
we're lucky
like the
to
Little
have,
Mermaid with her years
you know,
ago.
As you two can tell me, too, we are lucky. And sometimes it's you know, all of a sudden Hamilton will come here and everybody. My hope for Hamilton was always that so many people, that a lot of people would see Hamilton who had never been to a play before and would say to themselves, wow, I hear we have a lot of theaters here. What to your mind, you two, you've been here such a while and experienced. What keeps the vital nature of Chicago theater? It's not the famous, you know, storefront, you know, me seeing Grease on Lincoln Avenue in 72. But what, it is still such a magnet for talent.
Mm-hmm.
Why hasn't it been ruined? I mean, I've always found it to be nurturing and collaborative, and maybe that's the answer, but I'd rather hear from you two.
I mean, there's over 250 theaters in Chicago. 250. And when actors from kids from all around the country, if they want to go into theater and they don't have their equity card yet, for instance, and they want to cut their teeth, they know to come to Chicago because they could work at a storefront theater that's doing some enormous musical on a postage stamp stage.
Yeah.
Or they can audition at Drury Lane or the Mercury or other theaters where our Chicago Shakes, or they can get their feet wet and work with amazing professionals who've worked all around the world.
This is also a town that acts, and I don't just mean, you know, in straight plays, in musicals too. There is an energy to Chicago theater performers that's a little bit different, and maybe it has to do
with the Chicago style. It's a Chicago
background.
Style.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. But there, everything is alive. I think sometimes when we, and I'm not dissing at all New York productions at all, but sometimes there can be a fit the suit type of mentality a little
bit. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And I, like, for myself, I can say I never got typecast here, because if I went to New York, I would have been, not anymore, but an ingenue, and that was the track that I filled. But here, I got to play the sexy one, and I got to play the ingenue, and I got to play the leading lady. So we don't get boxed in maybe in the same ways that we would by our physical appearance, I think, in other places.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true.
One of the things, too, do you not both agree that the audience here is a little more adventuresome and at the same time pretty discriminating, mm-hmm. too? They will not accept junk.
No, and they don't, like, for instance, they won't stand up. There's not the requisite standing ovations that they have in New York, because they've spent so much money on that darn ticket. In Chicago, if they don't like your show, or if they thought it was fine, they're going to sit. They are going to be glued to those seats. But if they like your show and they get a standing ovation, I'm about to open Spamalot the Mercury, and we've had four previews, four standing ovations. So you know that there's something there, mm-hmm. because if they're getting off their butts, that means they must like the production. And there are other shows here in Chicago where, you know, they're highly lauded. Then you go in there, not one person standing, because they're like, nope, I am discerning. I'm a discerning Chicago theater goer, and yours was just fine.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
There is something interesting, too, about having a community of actors here that people have seen over and over
again.
And sometimes people complain about that, you know, the kind of cliquish nature. But if you sit in the audience, you will hear someone say, my husband has said this. Yeah, I heard them say, oh, I saw her in this and this and this. And the audience loves that, I think, actually.
I'd like to know what you think. I think that familiarity builds affection.
I think so.
It does.
Mm-hmm. Because they know us. They're invested in us as performers, and they're also not going to accept us doing the same role over and over again.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. They don't want to see you playing soprano, ingenue in this, and this show. They want to see, how are you stretching? How are you? Are you going to do a contemporary show versus a R&H show or a Lloyd Webber show or a Lerner Lowe show? Are you going to do something new, something edgy?
You know, I think if people go out and buy Mark Larson's book Ensemble, you'll be able to get it's an oral history of Chicago theater from, you know, from the early days of Second City, with, you know, 400 interviews, and I think you'll get at more than three of us, smart as we are, can get at in the next 5 minutes.
Right.
Again, Season of Concerned Divas, Monday, September 9th at 7:30 at the Mercury Theater. There are lots of cool restaurants in that neighborhood still.
So many.
Cullen's Pub, is Cullen's Pub still there?
No, we converted the space
to Michael Cullen.
Well, it was nice. Michael did come over and give us his blessing, but we converted it to a new theater. It's next to the Mercury, called Venus Cabaret Theater. It seats 80 people, and it's a cabaret-style theater, much like Studio 54 Below.
Yeah.
And that's our new space. It's one of the most state-of-the-art theaters right now in Chicago, because we were
When did you
to,
open that?
A year and a half ago, we opened it with Stephen Sondheim's company.
Wow. Wow. Now you all needed to get Michael Feinstein to come in.
Oh, well, my gosh.
Yeah, you'll have to build out some seats. You two are delighted. It's always wonderful for me to meet new members of the Chicago theater community. My father was a drama critic, and apocryphally, I think my mother went into labor when they were sitting in the Studebaker Theater.
Really?
So he never reviewed the show. And by the time I was old enough to ask her, she goes, "Well, I don't remember the show. Your dad never reviewed it." So that's how far back I go. Corey Goodrich and Eugene Dizon, they're the co-producers of Season of Concerned Divas, which is Monday, September 9th, 7:30. They're recording there, so it's going to be a CD. Don't you want your laughter or your clapping sound be part of the soundtrack?
But not your swearing.
No swearing.
The Divas might. You never know if they drop a, something, if they
How long does the show run? Hour and a half, 2 hours?
We're hoping for 90 minutes.
That's perfect. All right. Doesn't everybody? Yeah. Doesn't every theater company in the world? Only 90 minutes. No intermission. Don't worry about it. It's a delight to meet both of you and knock them dead. And Jane Solins, even though you don't have a theater anymore, you're still producing. This is a Jane Solins. I think of this as a Jane Solins production. It's nice to meet your husband, too. So take care. We'll be back, and we'll be talking about Harold Washington for the rest of the show. Welcome back. For those of you who read the Sunday newspaper, and I understand that there are, encouragingly and astonishingly, 400,000 of you who still get a Sunday Tribune. In that paper, you can get to it today. You don't have to read it now, but you can get to it today or tomorrow. Maybe you got to it earlier today. There's a long piece in the arts and entertainment section about a upcoming documentary titled Punch 9 about... They don't come much more towering than Harold Washington. One of the producers, Raymond Lambert, is in studio. Director-producer Joe Winston is on the phone. We may pull Joe in, or we may just spend 10 minutes now talking about Joe Winston. Raymond, it's a pleasure to meet you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
I have not seen any of the film, but writing about it and interviewing Joe compelled me to go back and look at the ample examples of Harold Washington that exist on videotape, on a few horrible, to my mind, documentaries that were made right after his death by local television folk. You don't have to say any of this. I'm saying it. Okay. These horrible, sickeningly idolatrous and that didn't seem to get Harold at all. How do you tell me about your history, if there is one, with Harold?
So I moved to Chicago in 91, so I was not here during that time. So it's really, I knew of him because I grew up in the Philadelphia area, so Wilson Good was our guy at that particular time.
Oh, yeah.
But so I was paying attention, but not to the extent that I have becoming a part of this project.
Well, and Joe was in high school. I mean, yes. He knew Harold and shot him once in Rockefeller Chapel. In seeing... Well, did Joe call you and say, "Hey, I'm working"?
Yes.
How does a documentary world work?
Sure.
Did Joe say, "Well, you're a very accomplished man. You won a Peabody Award, or what? Did you,
sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
How does that work?
I didn't want to do another documentary, to be honest with you.
Why?
They take so long and so much time. It's so difficult and so hard that I just thought, after Maya Angelou, that was enough for me. And then Joe said, "Well, just take a look at this. I've got like 7 minutes. Why don't you just take a look at it and tell me what you think?"
That's how it happened. It was 7 minutes, much of it featuring Harold.
Yes.
Your initial reaction, I know you can't take me back to the
visceral
feeling you had at the time, but this was, to my mind, one of the most viscerally charismatic human beings to ever walk on this planet.
I agree with you in total. And in that 7 minutes, and as you know, Joe's a fantastic editor.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe the story hadn't been told again. And I'm thinking, I'm a sucker for being a part of telling a dynamic story that I think would resonate with a lot of people, and this was amazing. So
let's get Joe. Joe's on the phone somewhere, maybe having some incredible Labor Day. I know you're not at the Burning Man Festival, Joe. But what was, Joe, what was the 7 minutes that you showed Raymond that hooked him on the project?
Hi, it's Joe Winston here. Yeah, I showed Raymond what we call a sizzle reel, which was just it's the trailer for the movie that's not done yet.
Right.
And basically it was just enough to draw you in if you didn't know about Harold Washington, sort of the incredible ups and downs of the 1983 Chicago mayor's race. That put him in office, and the way that he built his coalition, and then he wins the Democratic nomination, and then suddenly the Democratic Party and the white voters all abandon him for somebody named Bernard Epton, whose slogan is "Before it's too late," and Harold barely ekes out a victory, and then he wins, and then the city council abandons him, and the council wars begin.
Yeah.
And I think that I managed to convey enough of, we stole music from action movies for it because it was just a demo, and it had enough of this. It gave you this roller coaster ride that I think gave Raymond, you know, who wasn't here, and somebody who wasn't here, a feel for just how incredible that moment in time was.
One of the reasons, as you told me in the piece that's in the Tribune today, and you people should read that, you 400,000 who still get the paper, was one of the reason motivating factors for you, Joe, was the fact that you were worried that, especially in the sort of misguided euphoria that followed the election of Barack Obama, that people had forgotten Harold Washington. Yes?
And I think more importantly, forgotten not only who Harold was and his complexity, you know, not just a black first, but somebody who had an ambitious agenda, but also forgot the battles that he fought and what they meant, what his vision was for Chicago, and how that telescopes out in this way that's almost Twilight Zone eerie to the struggles that our country is going through today.
Well, we all thought, and please, Raymond Lambert, get in on this, too.
Sure.
We all thought in the wake of the Obama election that we were in this some kind of post-racial society that was going to be good, and it turned out to be anything. It turned out to be what's flipped 8 years later to be a kind of bizarro world in the wake of that. What do you think?
Well, for me, I guess I didn't have personally... My expectations weren't
okay, sure,
because I've sort of been here before, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's what Harold reminded us of. And I think, having studied some of the other mayors, I was in Atlanta when Maynard Jackson was mayor, so I had seen different things happen before. So, I kind of, you know, I thought the expectations were a little bit outside. I did not see what's going on now. I really didn't see that, but. As Joe was saying, I've had the opportunity to study Harold, study that particular period of time, and it is eerie, the similarities to where we are today.
Yeah. You are an African-American man,
yes.
I must say. Unless we're on TV, it's sometimes hard to tell on radio. I could be an African-American man. Joe, what was it about, not for you guys to get in a mutual admiration society, but what was it about, how did you meet Raymond Lambert, and why did you think he would be a good collaborator for you on this project?
Well, Raymond and I have both worked with Bob Hercules, with whom Raymond made
sure.
the wonderful, biopic on Maya Angelou. And so I was casting about for, I needed some additional producing muscle power to get this Harold Washington film off the ground, because it's a big lift to do Harold justice. It's a lot of work, and I needed teammates on this journey.
What did you think when you first met him?
Oh, Raymond?
Yeah.
Well, Raymond comes from an interesting background, because I had helped him with a piece on comedy. You know, he has a history running a black-owned, black-focused comedy club in Chicago. So Raymond comes from a very interesting background. I like working with people like that, you know, who might be coming at a subject sideways. Because one of the things I think that destroys a lot of civil rights documentaries is being a little too pious. I think you alluded to that earlier.
Yes.
Yep.
For sure.
Yep. Oh, you did. You worked
I think
on
we the- worked on the Chris Gardner Happiness Bank video. I think that was the one time you edited that, I think, Joe. It was a short. I don't know if you guys know Chris is from the Pursuit of Happiness.
But did you work on that documentary Funny Business?
Yes, I did.
Man, did I love that show. I may have had you weren't on the radio, or I may have even written about
right.
it. That was about, you know, I used to cover comedy as a when the comedy boom of the 70s
sure.
and 80s happened, I covered
Alan Johnson and that.
Oh, Alan was one of my great pals.
Yeah,
one
I
of
miss
my
him
great
daily.
Pals. So you did that. So you
yes.
had a talent. When you you start to gather this team, Joe, who else gets involved? I mean, when you say you need this producing muscle power, and indeed making you do have, I'll talk about your Kickstarter thing too, because I want you to raise the money you need to make this kind of thing. It is hard to make. That's why Raymond didn't want to make another one.
Exactly.
Who else do you enlist?
Well, Sonia Jackson is with us too. She's helping produce the film. She comes from a foundation background. So she has a really interesting and deep presence in that world, and was drawn to the story of Harold Washington. And she's also going to help us generate an impact campaign to use the film, you know, once it comes out, to actually make a difference. for all the people who don't know Harold's story and can learn from it.
Are you, I know you thought this at the beginning, and Raymond, you may have too, but it occurs to me, and certainly I have been getting emails since that piece was posted online from people who literally had almost forgotten, some had forgotten Harold, and some were way, Joe, probably, 10 years younger than you. They were alive maybe when he got elected, but they have no sense of who this guy was, because there isn't much. Yeah, well, there's a Harold Washington Library.
Sure. Well, what's interesting about that, we did, we're working closely with Harold Washington College. It's a professor there, Asif Wilson, Dr. Wilson. And he told us about a study that he did. He did a survey of 100 students that attend Harold Washington College, and he asked them, who is Harold Washington?
This is going to hurt me, isn't it?
Less than 15 people knew.
Oh, my God.
They thought it was just a name on a building.
Wow.
So I think that's an important part of it, as Joe's talking about, that we, as Joe calls it, and he says it better than me, we don't want him to become a Santa Claus. And
yeah,
I think
Black
that's a
Santa
great
Claus.
Quote, right?
Yeah. Joe, thanks for being on the phone wherever you are. You're going to be on the phone for another half hour because I really want to get the initial reaction to that story in the paper today is pretty encouraging, not to me as a writer, but should be encouraging to you as documentary makers.
That's great news.
Those people who do remember him with astonishing fondness, in part because of the people. Bruce Elliott, the owner of the Old Town Ale House, who's older than I am, said, best mayor in my life, hands down. And we know what he means.
We need to call him, Joe.
We know what he means by hands down. Good screening at the Old Town Ale House. So, Joe, stay on the phone, and we'll continue this conversation after the news. Chicago Stories told 24/7 on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users, just say play WGN Radio on Tune In. It is 10:30 on the dot, and here with the news brought to you by Team Hochberg is, and Roger Badish, you may want to come in here because you had a relationship with Harold Washington, too.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, so think about coming in here when you have finished delivering the news.
Sure.
Thanks.
Okay.
Welcome back. If you are a reader of the Tribune, you saw a piece in the Sunday Tribune that still goes to 400,000 homes in this area about. It's part of the Arts and Entertainment Fall Preview section, but there's a picture of a man named Harold Washington in there and a story in there about Harold that mentions, and not only he, but my guest, Raymond Lambert, who is co-producing this thing with director-producer Joe Winston, who is on the phone with us. And Joe and I go way back. Joe's been sort of telling me about this for a couple of years. Joe, you've really been working on this for about 5 years, haven't you?
Yeah, it's taken a long time to really plumb the depths of Harold Washington. We've tried to talk to as many people as we can who knew him, who worked with him.
Yeah.
Even people who worked against him.
You said that some of the so-called enemies, most primarily Alderman Ed Burke of the 14th Ward and Ed Verdoliak, Fast Eddie of Council Wars of the 10th Ward, did not, and probably, to my mind, probably never will talk to you. But Dick Mell did. Dick Mell, who of the 33rd Ward, who famously stood up on the desk in the wake of Harold Washington's death and the horrible fight to take control. You found him to be pretty open, didn't you, Joe?
Yeah, I think enough time has passed. One of the good things about that is that, maybe people have some perspective on that time. And Mel was interested in reflecting on it. He gave us a window into kind of how the city worked back then. And, what he stressed was the fact that the people who ran the city, who were all white men at that time, were very threatened by somebody who was not only wanting to give black people their fair share, but to change the way things worked, make it a real democracy. They weren't ready for that.
You've interviewed some 45 people, I think. I even got a note from, after the story appeared online, from Bernie Upton's son, Dale, who said, I wonder if Mr. Winston would like to talk to me. And I'm thinking, yeah, probably would. I have in the studio Roger Badish. Pretend that we're interviewing you for the Harold Washington documentary.
Okay.
And you don't have to tell the inside details, but you helped Harold hook up his stereo system in his house. How did that come to be?
Well, the staff wanted to give him a Christmas present. And so they bought him a component stereo system.
And you were doing what at the time? You weren't working at some record store.
No.
Yeah.
No. I was in the mayor's press office. I was the only press aide that was held over from Jane Byrne.
Why do you think that was, Roger? I don't think I've ever asked you that.
I don't know. I like to think that it's because I was competent in my job, that I knew what I was doing. Part of it was, I think they couldn't get anyone that would come in at 4 o'clock in the morning.
That's a good reason.
To review the videotapes. I used to videotape all the newscasts from the previous night and then edit them down to Chicago stories, things from different Chicago departments, dub copies of it and give it to Chief of Staff. Where and to the mayor's office, the mayor's press off press secretary,
Alton Miller.
Well, even before
Alton, Laura Washington,
yeah.
Or
no,
Sneed.
Laura was the assistant press secretary, Grayson Mitchell.
Right, Grayson. Right. Yes. So that's what you're
so
doing.
So that's and- what one of the things that I was doing. I was also in charge of all the public service announcements for all the city departments. We had started up a program under Jane Byrne that kind of brought all that together under one umbrella and tried to get more publicity out there for all the different projects that the city was doing. My belief was that, you know, we're doing the public's work here.
Yeah, sure.
Your tax dollars are paying our salaries. We are doing these programs for
Jesus.
You should know about
Jesus,
it.
Jesus, does that make you an unusual city employee?
I know.
What, are
I
you
know.
Kidding? I'm surprised they didn't put you in jail.
Why should I do that? I originally started with Jane Byrne, but working in the as the press aide in the Streets and Sanitation Department. So when I was hired there, that's where I started, and then I became the photo editor after Fred Rohde's daughter went home to have a baby. I took over the photo editor's job for
So Chamber. When Harold, did Harold himself say, hey, I'm keeping you?
No, I don't know how it happened. That day after the election, I went into work. It was later in the evening. Grayson Mitchell was there. Steve Cruz, who had been the assistant press secretary under Jane Byrne, was still there. A couple of other people from Jane's administration and from the incoming administration had to put out to the media a press release of all the new officers, all the new top people in the new administration. And apparently I'm the only one who could type fast enough. I'm not kidding.
I'm serious. This is actually fascinating.
I was there. It was late in the evening. A lot of the people had gone home already. And I'm sitting at a keyboard. This is 83.
Yeah.
So the computers aren't that great in 83. You know, they weren't even computers. They were word processors. And they're dictating to me all the bio info. We put out two documents, and I have them on my website, on my Facebook page. I kept them.
Wow.
And it's a separate biography and then a press release about who was going to be appointed in what top position. And I'm sitting there typing out.
When did you first meet Harold face-to-face?
Oh, wow. It had to have been at some point in the office.
Yeah.
It was before the moment you asked me about when he got the stereo system.
Well, you're in his apartment. You're intimates by
Well,
then.
We played a trick on him because we had a small little boombox that we were supposedly playing music out of, and I had the stereo system I'd already put together, which was now playing. I had it in boxes, hiding. And this is in the press conference room outside of his office because that's where the staff Christmas party was. And so I said, hey, Merry Christmas. This is your boombox. And he goes, he kind of gave a little look, a little chuckle. And I said, nah, we're joking. And I opened up the package. you know, I pulled the boxes out of the way, and he loved it. And I have three pictures from that that were taken by staff photographers.
Yeah, they'll take those.
And so it shows him kind of looking at it and then kind of doing a little dance. I had to then pack it up and bring it to his apartment.
Put it in there.
And a few nights later, I'm up there. His coffee, I don't know what you call it. His consultants, his friends, who were not City Hall employees.
Right.
Guys from the hood that he had known for decades were there. And I walk in, and they're all sitting there having dinner. He had a glass table in the front room, and they were all sitting on the couches around it. And the apartment was sparse. There was hardly anything in there, and everything was immaculate in its place. The only place he had a lot of stuff was in a what I take to be his study. And there was no desk in there. There was just a very large Naugahyde type of reclining chair.
Sure.
And on all four walls, floor to ceiling books.
Wow. Well, he did love to read.
Yeah.
I mean, aren't you excited? I mean, what are your feelings about?
I'm loving this. There's not only a ton of stuff that I've got, but there's the Harold Washington collection at the Washington Library.
Yeah, they've been very
box by box. And if you go online and do enough searching for me, my name in one of the boxes pops up.
Oh, my God.
So I've been boxed.
As the only honest man at City Hall. Joe, just listening to Roger talk, you must have gotten tons of interesting stuff from the other 45 people you've interviewed. Joe, what they've told you is you were a young man when Harold was first elected. You're still in high school. Can you give me a sort of general idea about how your feelings about Harold may have changed in getting loaded with all of these details and impressions from other people? You admire him more?
Absolutely. I was prepared for Harold Washington, you know, as the sort of pugnacious fighter for civil rights, because that's what I remembered from 1983, you know, all these years later. But what it took some digging to appreciate was the breadth and the depth of his vision for Chicago.
Yeah.
You know, the way that he included everyone, and he did not have to do that. You know, it would have been enough for him to just be a civil rights figure, but he went much further than that, and he seemed to have a plan, kind of like they talk about Elizabeth Warren right now. He had a plan for everything.
Yeah.
You know, it was sort of the dream job that he was ready for. And it's just so inspiring, because I think that if we could, I think it's important not to put too much on one man, right?
Sure.
And people in the black community know that all too well, right? Your hero dies and the movement falls apart, and that happens again and again and again. But what he did and how he did it is something that we can all learn from.
Raymond, you must feel the same way. I mean, just I saw you listening to Roger talk here, and it's just insight and information. And
I think the other thing is not being born and raised in Chicago.
Yeah,
for me.
I think this is good that you're not from here.
It's not only a national story, but it's an international story. And we've uncovered footage from all around the world with him. And people have said to us, they're like, we didn't treat him as a mayor, we treated him as a statesman.
Mm.
So he was followed, and people listening to him. And this election was so important. And I feel like I'm preaching to the choir with you guys. Yeah. But one thing I discovered was this. There was impact. We've got interviews with Tom Bradley who was saying, we're all watching because if Harold can break through in this city.
In this town,
it can have impact throughout the nation.
Yeah.
Well, it's fascinating. I'm going to tell you about there's a few more days left for the Kickstarter campaign to help raise the money that it takes to make this kind of thing. I'll tell you more about that after a short commercial where I'll tell you Get Real in the Morning with Larry Potash, Raman Baumgarten, Paul Conrad, and the entire WGN Morning News team weekdays at 4 to 10. We'll be right back.
December 7th, 1940.
It wasn't just a day that lived in infamy. It was a pivotal moment in American labor. The 1930s had seen union membership triple in the face of the Great Depression. Not just skilled and manufacturing workers, but other basic professions. Meatpackers, electricians, steelworkers, all organizing. And then the bombs came.
The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii.
President Roosevelt took the lead, creating the War Labor Board. At the time, the AFL and CIO unions both promised a no-strike pledge for as long as the U.S. was at war. And over the next 4 years, American labor truly created the phrase, Arsenal of Democracy, a war of production that FDR urged Americans to win. When it was over and it had been won, FDR summarized the new maturity of the labor movement with these words. It is to the real advantage of every producer, every manufacturer, and every merchant to cooperate in the improvement of working conditions, because the best customer of American industry is the well-paid worker. This great moment in labor on 720 WGN was brought to you by the proud union laborers and industry-leading union contractors of Chicago area Lesset.
Homeowners, there's never been a better time to permanently fix your low water pressure, discolored water, or pipe leaks by repiping your home today. Repipe specialists have been repiping homes for over 25 years. With 40,000 home repipes completed, they stand behind their work. They have perfected the most efficient process for customer convenience, repiping an entire home in just 1 to 2 days, patching your walls, and providing a lifetime guarantee. Repipe Specialists only uses high-quality PEX or USA Grade L copper pipe. And for a limited time, get 20% off and 0% interest. Repipe Specialists, the no-hassle, value-priced, all-inclusive repipe. Call today for your free in-home estimate tailored for your home at 800-216-0195. That's 800-216-0195. 800-216-0195.
Do you or a loved one struggle with a mental health condition? Have you lost a loved one to suicide? You're not alone. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention is dedicated to saving lives and bringing hope to those affected by suicide. Join AFSP Saturday, September 21st for the Out of the Darkness Chicagoland Walk at Montrose Harbor to help fight suicide. Walking together will bring these issues out of the darkness and into the light. To register or donate, go to chicagowalk.org/WGN.
When you fire up a John Deere 1 Series tractor, you can tackle the job without wrestling the attachments. Hook up everything from a front loader to a drive-over mower deck in no time, so you can haul gravel, cut grass, or do any job in between. Because when things just click, work just gets done. And now get a 1 Series for just $99 a month at your nearest participating John Deere dealer. Nothing runs like a Deere. Run with us. Search John Deere 1 Series for more. 0% annual percentage rate. For additional cost information, please call toll-free 855-633-2315.
Here's what's fresh in podcasts.
Fresh.
Right now on WGN Plus.
The Great American Bash is back in studio.
You better believe it, brother. We're back.
To check in on the race for the Democratic ticket.
Who's it gonna be? Biden, Sanders, Warren, Yang?
Dude, come on. I'm trying to talk here. So rude.
You're rude.
And Elizabeth Alfano was joined by the CEO of a company that makes plant-based eggs. Someone must be doing magic in the laboratory, because this is nuts. No, it's plant-based. Find them on WGN Plus, look in the back of your fridge, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Joe Winston on the phone is the director and co-producer of Punch 9, a documentary that we all hope will be finished by the end of this year and will come out sometime before the election season goes insane next year. I'm sitting in studio with his co-producer, Raymond Lambert. We just had Roger Badish in here telling what I thought was a pretty amazing story.
Absolutely.
I just got to think, too, Joe, for you, you've heard... You know, you interviewed my old pal Alton Miller, who I think was mayor's press secretary. Many of you remember him idiotically just as a guy who wore sunglasses on the top of his head. But he was the guy in the office the day Harold died, and is, I think, very insightful about Harold the man, too. Did you find that, fellas?
Yeah, because Alton traveled with Harold Washington wherever he went.
Yeah.
So I think he would ride in the limousine with him all over the place. So he got to watch him operate up close, and he had a sort of a keen sense for what Harold was up against, which was not just trying to, you know, manage his political opponents, but make real structural change.
Yeah. This Kickstarter campaign ends in, I think, just a couple days. Kickstarter is this organization. It's funded it's funded a number of projects of friends of mine, and it's a very effective way to not be beholden to,
yes,
you know, weird money people who might want to exert some kind of influence, but just the public. Raymond, talk to me about the Kickstarter.
Sure.
You go to Kickstarter. I suppose you just go to Kickstarter, Harold Washington, and you'll find it, right?
Yes. If you go to Kickstarter.com and punch in Punch 9 or Harold Washington, it'll pop right up. They've been a great partner. They are very excited about the film. They made it one of their favorites.
That's right.
And as you were saying, I like to say it democratizes access. And whether you have $5 or you have $5,000,
right,
you can participate and be a part of telling this story. So I think that's what makes it really, really great.
You must, as this gets closer to being completed, and you're sort of, you know, more than 2/3 of the way to your Kickstarter goal, that just, and again, it's anecdotal influence, that the buzz that you know, piece today in the Tribune created, it gives me a real indication that this is going to be something quite special. Does that, Joe Winston and Raymond Lambert, does that put any kind of, I can't imagine, Joe, I've known you for so long, it doesn't put any kind of extra pressure on you, does it? I think the pressure here is kind of as if Harold is looking down, and you want to get this right for him, because he was such a complex guy, I think. And his legacy is further complicated.
I'll let Joe start, but I certainly have an opinion on that one.
Yeah. Well, I certainly think that the main thing for me is that this is the last chance to make a film about Harold Washington where we could still speak to a large number of people who knew him.
Yeah.
And were there and were part of the story. So that was that was part of a sense of urgency, and it led us in the way of the foolishness of documentary filmmakers everywhere to rush headlong into this without, you know, having all the pieces in place as far as funding and so forth, because we just could not wait. You know, our first interview was Dr. Tim Yule Black, who at the time was 97. Now he's still with us at 100, but 101 or however old he is. But we couldn't have count. We couldn't wait for that.
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
I think also what I've discovered is everybody has a Harold Washington story, and everybody has a perspective. At least in Chicago, they do. So there's a certain amount of sort of pressure that we want to, you know, not only tell the story correctly, but we want to satisfy some of these audiences. But as filmmakers, what I think I also like about it is that we show everything, the warts and all.
Well, because, you know, the other thing about it, he was a human being.
Absolutely. Before we show that.
Before he was a politician, he was a human being. And I think the interesting thing, Joe, and I know to get into this, he and Tim were classmates at Roosevelt, were they not? Roosevelt University?
They had to be, maybe 5 years. They both have a history at Roosevelt.
Yeah.
I don't know if they were there at the same time or not, but they had to be close. So I think Harold will be 95 now, I believe.
What do you think? That's an interesting thing you bring up. What do you think? And it's not your place as documentary makers to include this in any kind of film. What do you think, Joe, you first? What do you think Harold would think of the city now?
Interesting. You mean, if he was like the ghost of Harold Washington presiding over us.
Yep.
I think he'd still, you know, I think he'd be pleased with some things, but I think he would still think that there was a lot of work to do.
Yeah, no question. You got to think
for
the
sure.
same thing,
Absolutely.
Raymond. I mean, he'd see some of these neighborhoods and rip his hair out, I think.
Absolutely.
Now, I know you guys would love to get Ed Burke and Ed Verdoliak, to sit down and be frank and open about this. But are there any other people, I was talking to Raymond off air about the President of the United States, the former President of the United States. I'm not sure this one would have that much to say. But the former President, Barack Obama, who a lot of people, I mean, the common, I think, misconception is, you know, kind of Barack is standing on the shoulders of Harold Washington. Are you going to try to get him to talk?
Raymond, I'll let you take that.
Okay. Yes. and we're still attempting, but obviously...
He's a book. Former president who's right. got a book to write, and he's got a daughter going to college.
I've taken to telling my kids that, I said, hey, guys, we got turned down by the president again today. We're getting closer to yes.
I think we'll get it. I think it would be a terrible mistake for him not to be part of this. And the other notion that, Joe, you and I talked about a bit, that you guys have so much material that I... now like, as opposed to being wary of it, the new landscape that is television now with Amazon Prime and Netflix and, you know, I don't know if Walmart's making TV shows. I don't know what's going on. But to make this documentary a two- or three-part series, because this is it's a big, big story, fellas. Do you agree, Joe?
We certainly have enough material if one of the streaming platforms wanted to do a limited series, because when you know, to understand Harold Washington, you have to understand Chicago, you've got to understand the machine, Richard J. Daley. It's a lot. It's a rich, deep, complex story with colorful, fascinating characters. And if we had that much time, we could go that deep.
Yes. Well, I hope you guys are able to pull that off. Joe, you know how much I've ever admired you from the This Week in Joe's Basement days, which Raymond tells me he's never seen an episode.
He won't send me it.
Why is it? You won't let him watch one? Joe?
He has not put one in Dropbox. That's his favorite.
I wish I should have kept the tapes. I should have kept the tapes. But I have and the other documentary you made after that Joe kind of discovered Burning Man, and I had never even heard of Burning Man, and he came and said, you want to review this show, Rick? And I said, what is this? And now it's turned into, you know, some nightmarish Woodstock reunion kind of festival. Joe, I've always admired your work, and Raymond, what work I've seen of yours, that Funny Business was just one of my all-time favorite documentaries.
Thank you very
talking
much.
About the black comedy club scene. So I am as excited as anybody out there about this. Go
Thank
to
you.
Kickstarter, Kickstarter.com, Harold Washington. You'll find it. You can $5, or if you're, you know, some kind of millionaire sitting there, give them $1 million.
I'll take it.
Yeah, I bet you will. But it's hard. It's hard work. I mean, this is years of work, and it moves slowly. And there's, like today, here's Roger Badish. The newsman comes in here and tells this amazing story that sounds like it's likely to be some small part of this whole thing. Raymond, it's a pleasure to meet you
in
person.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joe, thanks for everything, and keep me posted, will ya?
Sure, Rick. If you have 30 seconds, I can give you a quick closer.
Sure.
It turns out, according to his press secretary, Grace Mitchell, that Harold Washington did have contact with Donald Trump. At the time that Harold was mayor, he was starting the process of trying to redevelop Navy Pier, and then real estate developer Donald Trump apparently came to town wanting to get involved, and the two, shall we say, did not see eye to eye.
I hope Roger Badish has a VHS tape of that meeting. That is fabulous. Joe, take good care of yourself and keep me posted on all this.
Thank you.
Raymond, thank you for coming in the studio. Thank you all for listening out there. Dan Long, thanks for the engineering genius. Roe Coleman, thanks for the producing expertise. Carl Amari will be coming up, and I will see you all on the radio next Sunday. Chicago Stories told 24/7 on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. It is 11 o'clock on the dot, and here with the news
is... It's like Don Kleppen's up there.
Who? Who's... Oh, look, we have TV in here. Hello, Don.